This is The Lisa Show with Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T.
Are you discouraged by how much you and your partner fight? Coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to tell you how you can use those fights to grow closer together. It's okay to admit that school can be boring sometimes. I remember being a student and struggling to remember anything I learned from an especially boring class. And I'm,
you love learning.
I'm a lifelong lover
of learning. But I feel you. There were those classes where it was like, okay, can I please get through this?
And I think as you get older, you think, am I going to get through this? Because you're trying to find a connection. You get a little bit better at that as you get older. But retaining information and performing well on exams is harder when you find either the material or the way that it's presented boring. So to counter this problem, neuroscientists tell us to engage our emotions when studying and try to relate the topics we discuss in the classroom with our day-to-day life. And when I was in my teacher training classes, they told us the same thing. Like, you've got to find a connection, show them why it's important. It's difficult to do, but here to tell us what that looks like and why it's important is neuroscientist Mary Helen Imordino Yang. Welcome.
Hi.
So I want to start off first with this idea of engaging our students' emotions. What does that mean?
Yeah, so that is a super question, Lisa, because actually what we're learning about teenagers' brains is that maybe engaging emotions is actually a different thing than we thought. We think about engaging emotions as just like, having a big reaction to something, like something that's really like in your face, right? Like
right.
Really shocking people with something like that grabs them. Or we think about it as kind of almost tricking yourself into like making it, quote unquote relevant, like, oh yeah, I'm going to need this math in my real life.
And you're
like, not really, right? Like, oh, come on, teenagers don't buy that anymore, right? They're like, yeah, show me where, right?
Yeah.
But what we're learning actually is that making things engaging is really about making them relevant, but relevant is something different than we used to think. So what relevance is not just that you can see the direct connection to like utility in your day-to-day life, like, learn how to do this math and you'll be able to balance your checkbook. Okay, yeah, you need to be able to balance your checkbook, but that's like lower R relevance. What big R relevance really is a set of kind of emotional feelings that are actually invoked inside the very basic survival-related structures in your brain and brainstem that we share with alligators, right? This very, very basic feeling of being like really alive and aware and awake and connected to what you're thinking about, because what you're thinking about really feels like it's part of the power of being you. To know this is like just a very powerful feeling, and that is what real engagement is. And how do you get that? You really get that not so much by choosing topics only that are like directly useful in your daily life. Like that's kind of the cheap way to get it, and that's okay. But how do you do that for things like math or physics or things
that's
really hard to show it, right? You get it by the way in which you engage young people in the thinking process. So what happens is, when kids move from thinking about really big, powerful ideas, like ideas that feel really insightful, like you know things you didn't know before, and when you look out at the world, you have like a new view onto, well, that's why the stars are out at night, or whatever it is, right? If you connect these really big ideas back to the little skills you need to have, right, like the math, the reading, the vocabulary, right, and then take those back out into these big ideas again by having these conversations about the really big ideas, it's that move back and forth that we think kind of like, ramps up the brain, like in this resonance pattern that makes you feel like, oh my gosh, this is really relevant, even though it's not directly like useful in your daily life. And we see this in kids, in teenagers who are really doing exceptional work in school, right? And these are kids from schools. There are schools like this in New York City. There are schools like this in Los Angeles. They're scattered throughout the country. But schools where kids are doing big projects, especially where they're really invested in the topic and they really care about like learning more about it. And as they become more and more expert in their topic, they tell us that they kind of show us by the way they talk to us about it, that they're moving back and forth from like, wow, this big, powerful idea of, you know, whatever the idea is, you know, social justice or educational, you know, access or how, you know, lead gets in your water or not, or, you know, all these kinds of things, these big, powerful ideas. And then they move back to like, and so the chemistry is like this. And as they move back and forth, that's what then they spontaneously blurt out to us, like, it feels so relevant to my life. Like, you're like, really? Fractions are relevant to your life? Because you've like got really excited about the idea of infinity? Oh, wow. You know
what
I mean? So it's a very different way of thinking about what relevance is. It's really about engaging people with big ideas and giving them the opportunity to, you know, become really deeply interested in something and to become an expert on it, maybe even more of an expert than the teacher, you know?
Wow.
And when you do that, it feels really empowering, and that's where the feeling of relevance starts to get generated in the brain.
We're talking with Mary Helen Amordino Yang about engaging our students with engaging emotions with students, and how I mean, like, it really feels like ownership, personal ownership, being able
that's
to
right. Personal ownership. That's a great way to say it, Richie.
To get in on this, and we've sort of couched this in the idea of the educational system. I think that this is a great lesson for any and all people, but parents listening to this, to get kids to sort of buy in within things within their home. I mean, these things very much apply.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is not something that's unique to the four walls of a school, right? This is how we become really invested in working hard and applying what we learn in the world. And really, you know, the way I think about it, it's like helping kids take what they're learning and build that not just into like, knowledge that's like separate from who they are as a person, but like feeling like this knowledge is what makes me a really like efficacious person in the world, you know? Like if you think about preschoolers, right? How many kids preschoolers, you know, just become super fascinated with some topic like dinosaurs, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it that we think all our 4-year-olds were just hoping they're all going to be paleontologists? You know, no, of course not, right? The reason we get so excited when they are really into dinosaurs is because they learn all this vocabulary that the parents are like, the tyrant of what, you know? And they get like really expert and they know all the parts, and the feeling of becoming an expert is the developmental process that really is engagement. That's it. And it drives itself forward. And as you start to experience that in one domain, then you learn almost like a proclivity or a disposition for becoming curious and becoming engaged in other domains. And that's how you learn to be a lifelong learner.
Do you feel, I mean, I think that so many parents try to do this with their kids, you know, and sometimes I feel like we as parents sometimes get in the way of that with our good intentions about what it means to be a good student or engaged. What are those things that you see that parents and teachers do unknowingly that interrupts this kind of natural like love of learning?
I do. I mean, God, I was a teacher too. I taught 7th grade science and stuff. I mean, I get it. I totally get it. And I'm a parent, right? I have 2 teenagers right now. You know, it's like, I totally get that. And I really do think that we adults often get in the way of kids really genuinely developing these skills because we have so many ideas about what kids are supposed to know and what they're supposed to be interested in and what counts as quote unquote a good student, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or quote unquote like a good person. And
and
we push those onto our kids. And really it's a process of helping the kids find themselves in the world, like learn how to become really interested in things and letting them follow those interests. And then you sort of slide in the academic skills and the scholarly skills along the way. Like, you know, if you're learning dinosaurs or whatever, you're learning vocabulary. You're learning how to talk. You're learning how to think scientifically. You're learning about categorizing. You're learning about evolution. You're learning about biology, right? There's like what does it eat? You know, there's so much information in that you're learning, and that's real information. We don't think of that as like, oh, that makes you a good student, but that
right.
actually is what makes you a good learner for life. And so much of what we do, I know this is controversial, and you know, like you can argue with me, but so much of what we do, I think, in our traditional education system, you know, through no fault of teachers, right? They're taught to do this, is that we directly institute policies that undermine this. Hmm. We require particular classes
yeah.
at particular times. You are 12, you should be doing Algebra 1. You're like, well, really? Like, you know what I mean? Doesn't have to be at 12. Could you do it at 9 or at 14 if you're a different, you know?
Yeah.
And we then take everything you do and we assign a standardized grade to it. You get a B. You get a B plus. Oh, well, because your work's better than her work, right? It's like, well, thanks a lot. You just took everything that I poured my heart into and reduced it to
yeah.
this dumb number. And on the other hand, you get an A plus, does the same thing. It says everything that I was really interested in, it's all just about this little letter that mm-hmm. I wrote on my quote-unquote transcript. I mean, it's not really about me and who I actually am as a person, right? So we really directly undermine motivation for deep thinking, I think. I mean, I know this is, you know, we can argue. But I think we undermine motivation for deep thinking and for engagement by the way that we structure our education system around grading and testing and things like that.
So opponents, I think, would then ask, well, what do you want, Mary Helen? You want a bunch
yes.
of people to come to a place and do whatever they feel like the wind blows them, and you know, learn
they've
all this.
They've got to get into college.
You know, and how do we give them grades?
How do you get into college? Right. Well,
yeah.
I'll tell you something. Colleges are starting much, much more to look at kids' whole profile, right?
Yeah.
They want to understand, is this kid really engaged with something? Are they really dedicated and interested in things? Can they stick to those interests and actually stand by them, and even when it gets frustrating or difficult or they have setbacks, you know, can they engage with their peers? Can they engage in conversations where they hear other people's perspectives? So a lot of the traditional things that we associate with quote unquote success in getting into college are really starting to lose some of their shininess. I mean, you know, the state of California, for example, has removed the need for standardized SAT tests for all of their state universities, right? I mean,
yeah.
these things are starting to get taken away because people realize they're very limiting and they give you a very limited slice of what a kid actually thinks like. And what they actually are inclined toward. And frankly, it does not even predict how they're going to succeed in college. But you ask a really more fundamental question, Richie, which is, how do we hold people accountable? How do we hold teachers and schools and kids and families accountable for the things that their kids know and learn to do? Because, you know, clearly this does not mean anything goes, right?
Right.
And here, this is where I think the new science can really inform the answer to that question. Because what we're looking for is not, you know, check off this box of knowledge, check, check, check. Although you do need to know those things, we want to start taking it to the next level and think about, how do kids build knowledge? Like, what kind of thinkers are they? And so there are really great models for
mm-hmm.
how to do this. And when it's done well, it's incredibly powerful and successful with all kinds of students across demographics. And so certain kinds of, for example, project-based learning, right, where teachers bring in expert panels and they engage with kids over time around their work, and the kids defend their work and they explain their work and they talk about it in a much more process-oriented way about, like, here's what I was thinking. So I got interested in this, and then I kept studying it and I realized, well, no, I don't really actually understand the chemistry of the lead in the water. So can you please, like, give me a chemistry book. I need to go back and take that class so I can start to understand, well, why does it hurt brain development to have this in our water? And then go back and think about the biology. And the kid becomes the driver who's organizing it and presenting it. And their work is judged, right, based on the quality of their knowledge and thinking and engagement with complex ideas, rather than just with, like, how do you spit back to me
right.
the questions that I've designed
yeah.
that you have to choose A, B, C, D, or E. And if you can, then I say you're done. And if you can't, then I say you're not done or you failed, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, something else I think is really, really powerful here is that we're showing in our lab now, we've been following, teenagers for, 5 years mm-hmm. as they grow up. And at the beginning of the studies, we engaged these teens in private conversations about the ways they think about the world. You know, what do they see in their community? What could they do to make their community a better place, right? For kids who live in a community with crime, you know, why do you think these things happen? For kids who live in other kinds of, you know, communities with other kinds of struggles, why do you think people litter? Or why do you think, right, that these mm-hmm. things are the way they are? And talk to them about that. Talk to them about how they make friends and what they care about and what they dream of for themselves as an adult. What do they want to be? And teenagers at 14 and 15 years old, and this is like also we measure the kids' IQ and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. It's above IQ. Like, so this IQ does not explain this, okay? Like, teenagers who are looking for the bigger meaning, who are trying to figure out, like, the system level of how things work and not just like, well, because she's a bad person and so she threw the, right. the cup out the window, or, mm-hmm. or those guys are bad, you know, they're in a gang and they did this. And so they got in trouble and they have to take the consequences, which is all true, but that's not the full picture of how this happens at the sort of societal level. And kids who are trying to figure out, well, what does this mean for me? What does this mean for my life's work? What does this mean for, you know, how I understand the world and myself in it? Those big curiosities and dispositions for understanding more and learning more, like I said, are not explained by IQ. They're above IQ. And they actually predict the growth of those youth's brains over time. So
wow.
kids who do this, we can predict that 2 years later when we have you back to the lab, we're going to see more growth in that child's brain, that teenager's brain.
Cool.
And that growth in the brain, in turn, the degree to which they do that explains statistically, in other words, it predicts how happy they are and how fulfilled and how much they like themselves as a young adult, how
wow.
much they do, how well they do in school,
oh,
how much they
amazing.
Like their work, whatever it is they're doing at age 20, 21, 22, are they in school? Are they in work? But that's not as important to us as, do you like it? Is this what you always dreamed of for yourself? You know, is this a fulfilling life for you? Do you like yourself? Do you like your partner or friends? You know what I mean? How happy are you? Those questions are actually predicted via the brain development 3 years before, which in turn is predicted, you know, by ninth graders and 10th graders, the way they talk about how curious they are about the world and how they try to relate the things they notice in the world or they see in the news or they learn at church or, you know, all the ways that kids are engaging with the community. As they start to make sense out of that, when they make big connections to big ideas about what it all means, and what's right and wrong, and you know, really start to build for themselves who they want to be and what they believe in, those kids are the ones that are growing their brains over time. And this is across demographic lines. It's across ethnic groups. It's across socioeconomic status. So it's not about how much money or education the kids' parents have as much as it's about the dispositions that the kids bring, which of course are also part of how they're parented, right? But
yeah.
it's not about money necessarily, and it's not about you know, educational achievement necessarily. It's about these big sort of inclinations to think about, well, so what does the world really work like, and who am I in it, and what do I care about?
Wow,
and why
those
do
big
I
knowledge
about
ideas. It's those a, big ideas.
Yeah, that's it, right, ideas.
It's exciting to hear. That. It's exciting to hear you speak so passionately about it.
I love
it.
That,
Dr. Mary Helen Imordino Yang, the professor and director of the USC Center for Effective Neuroscience, Development, Learning, and Education, or CANDLE. I bring up CANDLE because you can find out more about the latest in this study by going to candle.usc.edu. Dr. Yang, thanks for being with us. Coming up in 5 minutes, we'll tell you how to approach difficult conversations with your partner so that you don't end up fighting.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
about getting sick this winter? In 20 minutes, we'll tell you what you can do now to boost your immune system.
Fighting is a tough reality of all relationships. I mean, sometimes they're about trivial things, and other times they're over much larger issues, but they shouldn't define your relationship. They should give you and your partner an opportunity to grow. But how do you use your arguments to positively shape your relationships? Well, Kim and Penn Holderness, well known as the Holderness family from their musical parodies on YouTube, have recently released a book called Everybody Fights, Why Not Get Better at It? In their book, they share their most common fight fails, as well as equip readers with tools to engage and understand rather than go to battle with their partner. And today, they're here to tell us all about it. Welcome, Kim and Penn. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Now, before we go any further, I need to know if in the works there is an REM parody for your book, the song Everybody Hurts, except it's Everybody Fights. Please, please let me know that this is coming.
Did we do that? Did we do that already, Penn?
No, we've talked about it because it's fun. I do hear that song in my head every time I say the name of the book, but for some reason we haven't yet. Now, the way that our workflow goes is somebody says that and then the video comes out 3 days later.
Right.
Or like that afternoon. Yeah. We don't plan ahead well at all.
That's amazing. Well, you had so much great success doing that. And most recently, I really appreciated your ADHD video because, you know, working in the entertainment industry and having children, it was extremely relatable.
Well, thank you. And I mean, ADHD is an extremely subjective thing, right? There's different levels of it. People struggle with it in different ways. And I'm certainly not a doctor who can tell you that, like, oh, you're fine if you have this. Mm-hmm. But I have like, thanks to a patient wife and thanks to, like, good friends who have been patient with me, I've been able to kind of navigate through it and found some really positive aspects of it. And so that's kind of what the song was meant to be about. And the response has been really great.
Yeah, it's absolutely been phenomenal to see your rise really in your YouTube videos and your blog. You really have a way of connecting with humor, right? And that's what people respond to. People want to laugh about different issues. And you certainly do that in a big way with this next project as well, about talking about fighting, you know, something that, you know,
fighting,
we all know.
Think it's so funny.
Exactly.
You wouldn't think it's that funny.
So of all the books that you probably had buzzing around in your head, why did you choose this topic, Kim?
You know, I think because we do these silly videos, right? And we do laugh a lot. We laugh a lot in our marriage. And I think that's something that's helped our marriage. But we'd get these, you know, comments like, oh, you guys are relationship goals. You guys have the perfect marriage. And we're like, what? Us? No, you guys are watching the wrong videos. And I wanted to be really real with people that we've gone to counseling. Like, we've worked through stuff. We've hit rough patches. And we learned these principles about how to communicate better and how to fight better that changed our marriage. And the way we live our life is like, if we find something great, we want to tell people about it. And when people started making those comments, I was like, we could provide a service here. Mm-hmm. We could, in an entertaining way, in a funny way, talk like with our counselor about ways, like easy ways, you know, language changes that can really help people. So that's what we wanted to do.
You know, the discussion that I think socially we have is, you know, don't go to bed angry.
Don't fight.
Try and avoid the
compromise.
Fight. But you're saying everybody fights. Let's get better at it. Penn, as you've kind of embraced this journey of fighting with your lovely wife and being able to create with her, what have you learned about how you fight or fighting within your marriage?
I've learned a ton. So you said how you fight. My fighting style for decades has been just apologizing immediately and trying to get over the difficult part of someone being mad at me. Because I hate when people
Which
are mad
I love,
at me. I want
quite
everyone
honestly.
To love me.
I
right.
love it.
Yeah,
I love
wouldn't?
It when you just like, yes.
Yeah.
And Kim is the opposite, right? So she kind of knows how to hurt me and get, like, you know, she walks away or is icy or her body language changed, she knows that the profuse apology is going to come. So what we had done for a long time is a profuse apology. Okay, you're out of the doghouse. Okay, let's move on without actually addressing the issue at hand. So what I've learned is that you have to finish the fights or they're going to keep coming back. We talk about the three D's, denial, distraction, and delay, as ways to kind of get out of the way of fights. And we're kind of learning how to not use those and to really get to the crux of the argument. And the best way to do that, and here we talk about magic words, here's the biggest thing that I've learned from this, okay? Every fight that we have almost starts with either starts or continues with me saying, you're acting blank, or you should blank, or you're being really blank, instead of saying, I feel blank. Mm. So I projected onto her feelings instead of talking about my own. And ever since I learned how to do that, because you can't really argue with somebody's feelings, right? Mm-hmm. Those feelings are your own and you can't. And as long as those are out on the table, we start moving in the right direction when we're fighting. Not that we don't still fight, but so I've learned that you got to finish the fight and you got to talk about your feelings.
Okay, so you mentioned denial, distraction, and delay. Are those kind of coping skills that everybody does or things that you found yourself doing now?
I think it's the fights that we aren't having that are oftentimes the biggest issues. And we could put off talking about some important things because it's going to be hard, right? Like, so I think that we all do that. I think we do it in work relationships. I think we do it in friendships. We, you know, whether it's like, you know, I have an issue and we all have the same fights, right? It's like money, sex, and power. Mm-hmm. So we, you know, there's something happening. We all do it. And, you know, Penn and I talk about those in the book and things those stonewalling, the things we weren't talking about, the things we were ignoring are oftentimes the biggest rifts.
Mm-hmm. We're visiting with Kim and Penn Holderness about their book, Everybody Fights. I would be curious, because you guys are the fun, silly couple that does the, you know, the parody music videos. When you say, hey, we're going to come up with this relationship book and we've learned some things and we want to share it, how much resistance has there been to be like, hey, stay in your lane, silly music video couple?
Yeah. You'd like shut up and dribble, that sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we're already kind of used to that, I'll tell you the truth. Anytime we try to make any sort of, not even statement, but if we make a video that's not 100% vanilla, we will get stay in your lane comments from some people. And it's usually not a majority. There is kind of an expectation that we're going to be that funny, goofy family. I do think the fact that this is coming out in a different format, like it's a book, we clearly thought about it. people will understand that they're not going to open the book and see us dancing in our pajamas in a video. Mm-hmm. So I do hope that the following that we've built over the last 6 or 7 years is able to differentiate between the two. And I also hope that this kind of reaches people who aren't part of our normal group.
Yeah, that would be the vision, that like this people pick this up and it's helpful to people who have no idea what we actually do. But P.S., like, we've made the book pretty funny.
Yeah.
Like, we're, you know,
oh, yeah,
we know. Yeah. The publishers told us, like, women buy the marriage books, so like women buy these self-help books. But Penn's whole thing was, but it takes, you know, like the dudes have to be into it, too.
Yeah.
So what he wrote and what he wrote from his perspective, I mean, it's pretty entertaining. So hopefully, you know, it is a departure from what we normally do. And like, I don't know. Let's see. I have no idea if people are going to be open to it.
Hope so. Right. Well, you outline some of your fights in your book and how you learned from them. So you get really personal. And I'm wondering if you'd be willing just to tell us one of those fights and what you learned. Let's start with you, Kim.
So many. So we wouldn't do like a 10 fights. So many.
I love how you say that, you
know,
too.
So many fights. But the 10 topics that we thought that everybody thought about, which is like the, and one that I think is pretty universal is the I do everything, you do nothing. Mm-hmm. And so, and it kind of started in a funny way. And is that in our downstairs bathroom, the toilet paper ran out. And I was like, you know what? At that point, we had lived in our house for like 3 years. Everybody knew, everybody I live with, these three people I live with, know where I keep the toilet paper. And but nobody had ever bothered to replace a role ever. And I'm like, I'm just going to let this ride and see how long my family goes without replacing the toilet paper.
Oh, you are speaking my language.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell you guys, 1 week, 7 days. And so I went and I took to Instagram stories, and this is before Penn knew about Instagram stories. He still doesn't. So, like, let's be honest. But, like, and they, so what I didn't know is he was reaching back for the Kleenex, like in the back of the, like underneath the cabinet. But for seven days, one whole week, my family, and then, oh, and honestly, it would have continued, but somebody on Twitter alerted Penn that, like, she's roasting you on Instagram.
You better get and on so, this. Oh,
and this
funny.
Is like, we were still in like active counseling, and I went to him. I'm like, isn't this funny what I did? And also my family, they're so lazy. They do nothing. And he kind of turned the tables. He's like, well, like, first of all, like, why didn't you do it? Why didn't you ask them? And he got into the topic of, it's called secret contracts. Every relationship, whether it's work, relationship, friendship, marriage, you have made a secret contract, something you do, something you take on, that there was never like an agreement, a handshake. But I made the secret contract to refill the toilet paper. I was the one, I'm going to be the one that cooks the dinner. I'm going to be the one that folds the laundry. Penn also had a secret contract we discovered in our marriage.
Yes.
And by the way, not all secret contracts are bad. Sometimes they are really helpful and they really are useful. Mm-hmm. But Penn took on, and they only don't work when parties aren't in agreement of how this works. The deal he had kind of been carrying is, I have to be a full-time cheerleader for this family. I always have to be in a good mood. Mm-hmm. I deal with anxiety and depression. So Penn always felt like he had to be good time Charlie. And so, but, you know, Penn went, you know, we're going through some serious stuff with his parents, both of his parents have Alzheimer's and dementia.
Oh, I'm
to the
so
point
sorry.
Where, like, he felt like he always had to carry this good mood. And so finally we're like, no, dude, you get to be sad. Like, you can, I know you feel like you have to always be happy, but you're allowed to be sad. So we kind of worked through some really, like, funny, silly stuff with the toilet paper. And then also there's some, like, mm-hmm. emotional contracts we make of, like, how we conduct ourselves in a relationship. And so sometimes we just yell out, like, secret contract. And yeah. It means, like, okay, I need to, like, stand up and help with the dishes. Like, I'm not always going to be the one that does this. Or if I see he needs to be upset about something, I'm like, hey, dude, secret contract. I got this. I can carry us for a bit. You can be sad. You can take 10 minutes and be sad. I got it. I got this.
Hey, Penn, it's just me and you. Just a couple dudes talking now. What are you most excited about within the book to share with people that would read it? It's just me and you. It's just a couple guys.
Yeah, dude. Just me and you, bro.
Yeah, dude.
Honestly, the episode on sex.
It's a chapter, not an episode. Different format.
Well, Kim, it lasts 1.5 chapters, so you can't call it a chapter. It's
Ooh,
an episode when it goes
true.
Past one chapter.
Ooh, yes.
Same sort of, honestly, like, the headline of both of them is mature people ask for what they want.
Hmm.
But it kind of chronicles the intimacy that you have with the person. The fact that, like, when you first start dating someone, you're aided by all of this dopamine that gets released when novelty happens, right? Because novelty is the most, that actually releases chemicals in your body. And it's the reason why when people first start dating, they're kind of all over each other. And we talked a little bit about how to keep that novelty alive. And most importantly, just talking about asking for what you want in that realm as well. Which is not something I was used to. I think I just expected intimacy to always have this, like, form of mystery and novelty to it. But after a while, you have to talk about what you want. And once you get over that hump, it's, like, very rewarding. And I think that part will help marriages as well.
It's great. It seems like
I don't
there's
want to
such
get too
a
graphic
a,
about it.
Right.
Sure. Sure. But it's
an important element.
Yeah, a principle of, you know, mature people ask for what they want. We only have but a minute left with you guys. And I would be curious, of the things that we've talked about or the things that we haven't talked about, what would you really like to either reiterate or introduce at this point before we let you guys go?
I would reiterate that, hey dudes, You take care of your car. You take it in to get the oil changed, even if it's not completely broken down. You don't have to wait until your marriage is starting to break down to do a little bit of maintenance on it. That's what this book is for. It's the idea is to take good marriages and turn them into great marriages. if you've got a marriage that's in real trouble, you probably shouldn't read our book. You should probably get help. But if you're doing the best you can and you feel pretty good about it and you like some tips and tricks, like, why not take your marriage in for a tune-up?
Great. Well said. Kim, do you have anything to add?
I think that along those same lines, I learned through counseling that my role wasn't to necessarily complete Penn. You do not complete me, but my role is to be Penn's like chief hype man. My role is to be a witness to his story. And our marriage really changed and our fights really changed when I learned that my role, it was like a true partnership, and how to just make space for his story and make space for who he really was. And I hope that through this and through the principles of this book, that yes, they're silly and goofy and we are silly, goofy people, but if it can help at least one couple grow just a little bit closer, like, I will consider it a success.
No, such great advice and real encouragement, which I think is so appropriate for any, you know, for any couple listening, no matter where they are, just to want to feel encouraged and helped through difficult times, or like you were saying, a good marriage mm-hmm. that they want to take to the next level.
Now, Kim and Penn, it wouldn't be me if I didn't do this.
Oh, no.
Entertainers love to be put on the spot and say,
yes.
Hey, you know what? Be funny, monkey. Will you do this for us? So will you sing us out? We've been visiting with the Holderness family, Kim and Penn Holderness. You probably have seen them on Facebook, YouTube, all over online. Sing us out, you guys.
Everybody fights sometimes.
Amazing. One thing that we really appreciate at the Lisa Show is the opportunity to really connect with people. You know, we think of things that are important to our family, to our friends, in making connections and really living in an intentional life. And part of the way that we do that is with other people. So we really do love to hear not only from you, but what you and your loved ones are talking about and really concerned and interested in. So when you write an email, and when you put in the subject line a suggestion or an idea or a thought, it helps us to connect with you in a real way so that we aren't just in our own little echo chamber.
you can also find us on social media, wherever you direct message on your social media. That is a great way to get in touch with us. Again, those connection points. Maybe you think email and you think, oh, geez, I haven't written an email in eons. And then you look up eons and go, that's a real long time. Mm-hmm. You can send us a direct message, available wherever we social media-lize. Find The Lisa Show and connect with us there. Would love to hear from you.
Coming up in 2 minutes, we're going to tell you which foods actually help boost your immune system and which ones don't.
You are listening to The Lisa Show.
Are incredible at fighting any infection or virus that tries to attack it. But if we don't take care of our bodies, our immune systems are weak and become more prone to illness and disease. So what can we actually do to boost our immune systems? Well, this is an especially important discussion as we continue to deal with a worldwide pandemic and prepare to send our kids back to school, and also as we enter into cold and flu season. So we've invited pediatrician and friend of the show, Dr. Weston Spencer, to talk to us and share his tips about boosting our immune system. Welcome, Dr. Spencer.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So what factors have an effect on our immune systems?
Well, the immune system is super complex. We don't completely understand the immune system. In fact, it's kind of funny when we talk about the immune system. I think there's more medicines and interventions that have been aimed at suppressing the immune system.
Oh, really?
Over the years. Then boosting it. Well, you think about, you know, we're talking about a lot of autoimmune diseases, which are actually much more common than immune deficiencies. So we're actually really good at suppressing the immune system, like transplants and things like that, and rheumatoid arthritis and other autoimmune diseases. But we're not very good at boosting the immune system. Probably the only thing we found that actually causes a robust immune response to prevent disease are immunizations, right?
Really?
I mean, we know how to tickle the immune system and encourage it to respond in a way that helps prevent disease, and we're very good at that. We've learned a lot about vaccines over the years, and that's probably the only way to really specifically help your immune system fight an actual illness is vaccination. But there are lots of things that we talk about. You know, how do you keep your immune system healthy? It's just balance. It's all those things that we've talked about that everyone would think. You know, your grandma told you get plenty of sleep and exercise regularly and maintain a healthy weight and don't smoke and eat lots of fruits and vegetables. There are lots of supplements out there. Like you go into any store on the web, internet, and you're like, there's like thousands of supplements that promise to boost your immune system and this and that. And in fact, there's some data to support that those things do boost certain parts of your immune system. You can have a robust response here or there, but we don't know if those actually help fight infection.
Okay, so that is it totally makes sense, because I feel like that is the discussion that we're having worldwide when we're having debates on vaccines and supplements and vitamins. And it just seems like there's a lot of information, a lot of misinformation out there. So let's just break it down. How effective really are vitamins?
You know, if you eat a pretty varied diet and you're not like super picky or have intense food allergies that prohibit you from eating a variety of fruits and vegetables and healthy foods, then you probably don't need a multivitamin. There's enough vitamins in what you're eating. And you can always look at the labels and see what's the recommended daily allowance of this and that vitamin. But if you do have specific food intolerances or a super picky kid, for instance, that never eats a vegetable, then giving them a vitamin is really quite helpful. There are lots of different vitamins too. There's, you know, all the letters, the A, B, C, D, E, K, all those vitamins. But there's also other micronutrients such as, you know, selenium, iron, copper, folic acid.
Riboflavin. Zinc, don't forget riboflavin.
Which is actually a type of B vitamin. But yeah, there's lots of vitamins, and some are what we call water soluble and some are fat soluble. So like vitamin C, it's been, you know, we talk about vitamin C and you get it in orange juice. That's really important. You can take massive mega doses of vitamin C. Your body will only use what it needs. The rest just is eliminated in your urine. But for instance, vitamin D or E, or A, those are fat soluble vitamins, and you can overdo those. Those ones are fat soluble and they stick around in your body and they're not eliminated as easily. So it's possible to overdo some of those vitamins, but all the B and C vitamins, have at it. You can't overdo those. Those are fine. And they do help, but your body again is only going to use, what it needs. If you have a deficiency, then it can cause a problem, right? But so taking a multivitamin is not harmful, but if you eat a varied diet, not necessary. If you don't eat a varied diet, it probably is really helpful to have those, because all those vitamins are used as cofactors in the immune system to help it work better.
Now, when I think about immune systems, I think about the powder things that we can get that are like boost your immune system.
Yeah, and it's got lots of zinc.
Yeah, tons of a thing, right? Overdosing of this amount.
Yeah.
And they're fizzy. And so we feel like we're really helping ourselves out.
Just feel it go down. Oh, my immune system.
Oh, yeah.
So bubbly.
How effective are those?
So there's been actually quite a bit of research done on those things. And there's not overwhelming data to support that those do a whole lot for the average healthy person. So if it makes you feel better, great. They're relatively harmless. but the immune system, again, is so complex that even just, you know, adding zinc or adding one thing might boost a certain part, but it doesn't necessarily mean that it's the right thing for the right illness. So it's just more complex than that. And it's a shame to say, after all these years, we really don't know everything, and we don't know a lot. But for sure, those are not harmful, but generally are not enough data to support a universal recommendation.
We're talking with Dr. Spencer, friend of the show, about boosting your immune system and how you can really do it. Well, okay, so then if we are looking in the future and we think, well, you know what, I'm ready to start taking this seriously and I want to do it in the right way, how can we help us, ourselves, and our kids build up a strong immune system?
I think it starts, at a young age, just and living healthy, making sure you're getting adequate sleep, you know.
Yeah.
For toddlers and young school age kids, they should be getting close to 10 hours of sleep at night. And then as you get into adolescence, 8. And then as adults, we really need 7 as a minimum. So, mm-hmm. So really, really getting enough sleep and trying to eliminate stress in your life. And we don't really know. There's lots of studies that have been done on stress and infection. There probably is a relationship there that when we're overly stressed or have chronic stress that we're a little bit more apt to getting sick, or when we get sick that it's going to take a bigger toll on us. So I think trying to reduce stress in ways which exercise, regular exercise, really does help to reduce stress.
Yeah.
It's funny how you know, we just want to grab the fizzy immune booster and call it good, but
and
we're
a couple of handfuls of supplements and
right.
Call it a day.
But if you just get good sleep and exercise a little bit, actually probably does a lot more than those would do. And then eating healthy, helping kids develop a healthy relationship with food. I always tell parents, don't fight too much about making your kids eat this and that when they're young, but just offer it, just put it on the plate and let them pick and choose. But you show by example that eating fruits and vegetables and what you have in your house is basically what your kids will eat. So
you talk about regular exercise. What is that defined as? What am I regularly exercising?
Well, Richie gets really intense about
exercise. If America has taught me nothing, it's that you should go from 0 to 1,000 and do as much as possible. And I know that there really is a definition
a
of what regular exercise should and could be.
Yes, there is. And it's actually more than we think. It's not necessarily in intensity, but it's consistency. So for kids, the recommendation is that they get 60 minutes or 1 hour of moderate to vigorous exercise 5 days a week. That's a lot.
Yeah.
An hour. So, and that would count brisk walking, where you get your heart rate up, riding a bike, running, things like that. So, and that's, you know, age 7 to age 30.
Yeah.
After age 30, it's probably even more important to exercise regularly, but it doesn't have to, you don't have to kill yourself. But even 30 to 45 minutes, 4 to 5 times a week makes a huge difference. And again, you know, just jogging, brisk walking, treadmill, bike riding, swimming, playing a sport, racquetball, things like that really, really do well. There's little tables you can find about what your target heart rate should be and things like that. And it's generally, you know, 20 to 50% above your resting heart rate, does something to really help, cardiovascular support.
So maybe a little bit faster than just a stroll or, you know, like breaking a sweat a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
You should be breathing hard, but not doubling over.
Right. Did you hear that, Richie?
Listen, I know. I get it.
I'm just worried.
And I'm hearing the age recommendation. I mean, I can still go that hour 5 times a week, what with me being under the age of 30 and all.
Hilarious. So it must be a lot of pressure as you are a pediatrician and you're supposed to model all this, you know, behavior. Is this something that you struggle with or that you find yourself, you know, changing maybe your habits over the years as a physician?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's you should practice what you preach, right? So,
yeah.
But there are different, you know, we all have different times in our lives where you're just not able to do all the things you want, and then motivation waxes and wanes, right?
Yeah.
Throughout life, and so I think what's important is, and I think, you know, who I think leads the pack at this, I hate to say it, millennials are probably better at finding a work-life balance than the older generation.
Well, that's actually encouraging, though. I like hearing that.
That means we're learning.
Yeah. I think there's more emphasis on healthy lifestyle and relationships than that job or making tons of money or whatever, you know? So I feel like that's, you know, it's a trend that we're moving towards, and healthy, you know, healthy lifestyles is improving. And I'm not sure what accounts for that, but I feel like that's kind of the trend. Is there's a lot of, you know, just back to basics. Let's get balance in our lives. Let's get the sleep we need. Let's make time for exercise. Let's choose a career and a lifestyle that permits us to spend time doing the things that we enjoy outdoors with family. I think there really is a trend towards that. Whereas, you know, 10, 20 years ago, it was just more about the career and a little bit more cutthroat.
Dr. Weston Spencer, I got one last question for you before we let you go. You have the collective audience. You're grabbing them by the shoulders, and you're able to very seriously look them in the eye and give them that doctoral advice. What do you say to them?
Wash your hands and don't touch your face.
Okay. Simple.
I like it. We can do it.
I felt your gaze as you said that to me. Dr. Weston Spencer, a pediatrician at Alpine Pediatrics, a friend of the show, and always great to have you here. Thanks for being with us. There are so many holiday traditions. I'm talking like things that have been long held, things that you have done year over year year, or things born out of a pandemic, which is just a phrase that I wanted to commit to using today as we did the show. Born out of the pandemic that we are doing now. And we love to hear the stories behind traditions. Now, you know, maybe you do the, you know, let's gather around the Thanksgiving table and tell everyone what you're grateful for, right? Yeah. But maybe the reason why you do it is different from the reason why I might do it, or the difference why Lisa might do it. Not only the traditions, but we would love to hear the why of your traditions. We do pajamas on Christmas Eve. Well, why do you do it? Give us a little bit about it. It's a fun thing for us to not only be able to share other individuals' traditions on the air. So make sure also, I should say, that if you're sending them to us either in direct message or thelisashow@byu.edu, if this is just something you want us to know about but you maybe don't want us to share on the radio, you can say something like, hey, don't share this on the radio, but I just wanted to share this with you. Those traditions and sort of the why behind the traditions. It's fun for us, and it's a call out. Send those to us, thelisashow@byu.edu.
Coming up in 6 minutes, we'll find out what it's like to be in a family of professional actors.
You are listening to The Lisa Show.
You're listening to Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. It's The Lisa Show.
Do you consider yourself someone who has good balance? Coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to talk to the king of balance about his experience walking the tightrope. We watch our favorite actors and actresses on the screen and on social media, and a lot of times we feel like we know them personally, but do you ever stop and wonder what their real life is like? What do they talk about at the dinner table? You know, what chores do they hate? And what about our favorite actors whose whole families are in show business? What is that like? Well, today we're speaking with Paige Howard, actress and daughter of director and Academy Award winning filmmaker Ron Howard, to hear what it was like growing up in a major showbiz fam, as well as to hear about her current projects, including the new Nickelodeon show directed by her dad. Welcome, Paige.
Hi, hi, so happy to be here.
Thanks so much for being here. I mean, let's talk about growing up first. I mean, did you feel the pressure from either inside the home and the conversations around the dinner table to kind of join show business?
You know what? It was exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, there wasn't a whole lot of pressure put on us. We were deterred from getting into the industry until we were, you know, when we were 18, that was the deal. When you're 18, we can have some real conversations about it. It was really, you know, my parents kept us really close together. So we would hop around from set to set as my dad was filming. So we had a lot of really incredible, fantastic experiences on sets that way. And that in and of itself was a great education. But it wasn't until, you know, until we all decided in our own rights that we wanted to get into it, that they were like, all right, okay, now, you know, now we can move forward and sort of talk, have, you know, like more career conversations together.
I love the visual of the Howard family kind of gathered around Papa Ron. You know, he's directing something and he's like, kids, be quiet. I've got to get this scene right. I want you guys to be able to be here. Do you have unusual experiences that maybe you were exposed to because of who your family was that has guided you now that you've gotten into the business?
Oh, yeah, for sure. And it was very much the norm that my dad would be directing a scene and he'd have like one kid on one arm and like one kid wrapped around his leg and like another one like reaching for candy at craft service and, you know, them pulling us back by like our little hoodie, you know. So it was just a constant. I don't know how he did it, but yeah, we and so many experiences. I think one highlight that comes to mind right now is my dad made a film called Far and Away, and I was around maybe 4 years old when that was being filmed. And we, the whole family, we all went to Ireland, and we stayed in like this little old castle for a couple months. And then we moved to this, little two room cottage, where one of the rooms, we just threw a bunch of mattresses on the floor and like all four of us were sleeping there for a few months. And we would wake up and they would have, like little sheep would, cause it was, the cottage was so low to the ground, the sheep would like peek their heads in the morning. And it was really idyllic. It was so much fun. It was such a good time.
Wow. And here you are and you've grown up, you're in the business, you have a wonderful career. Congratulations on that. And you've got a new project right now, too, called Astronauts. Tell us about it.
Yes. So the Astronauts is with Nickelodeon. And it's a live action adventure about five teens who really, really intelligent, curious, charismatic teens who inadvertently find themselves launched into outer space, and they get on the spaceship because their parents are all astronauts. So they use their information, and then something, without giving too much away, something goes down, and they find themselves in outer space and having to do the mission that, you know, their parents were initially going to do themselves. I play the role of Matilda, who is the spaceship's artificial intelligence, so AI. So I'm constantly interacting with the kids, and we're solving problems together and going on all kinds of adventures. That's a show. It's really well done, and it's a lot of fun.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Paige Howard, who is the daughter of Ron Howard, about their collaboration. It's called The Astronauts. It's with Nickelodeon. Was there any trepidation about working with Dad?
No, not at all. He's executive producing this one. Mm-hmm. And he was really, you know, I've auditioned for Imagine, and I've auditioned for Nickelodeon several times over the course of my career. Mm-hmm. And so this is one of those that just kind of, it popped up and I was like, oh my gosh, this is really interesting. I loved that it was about space. I loved that it was about science. And I loved that we have, you know, these curious, intelligent teens, at the helm of the ship. And I also really wanted to dive into voiceover work. So this is kind of a unique opportunity to get to do that. So I auditioned, and, we went through the whole auditioning process. And I booked it, and it was really fun. You know, my dad has been, you know, my dad's perspective on the whole thing, and in our family, our perspective is, you know, shoot your shot, go for what you want to go for, and then if it's meant to work out, it will work out. But we don't get you know, too overly involved in all of that. We have pretty good boundaries, you know, family workplace boundaries. So he's been really supportive, but hands off, and I appreciate it.
Yeah, letting you have your kind of your own career like that, but shoot your shot. I like that. Just go for it.
Yeah, exactly.
When will the show be released?
The show is coming out. It's airing tomorrow night on Nickelodeon at 7 p.m.
Oh, so exciting.
Now, it's interesting noting the voiceover work, because Ron, being the voiceover for Arrested Development, I wonder...
Runs in the family.
Is there a nod? Is there... Oh, I'm teasing, of course. Has there ever been a project where all of the Howards have worked together?
Well, actually, bringing up Arrested Development, that was a huge highlight for our whole family. We did one episode, and my grandfather, who is actually the one, he made his way over to Hollywood from the Midwest, my granddad and my grandma. And my granddad has more credits than anyone in the entire family. And his last day on set ever, he never retired. His last day on set ever was this episode that he did where we were all on set together, and we were all part of this one Arrested Development episode.
Oh.
And then he, 2 weeks later, he ended up getting sick and passing away. But it was such an exclamation point at the end of his career. I mean, here's this man who... you know, made this whole life possible for all of us.
Oh, wow.
And his last credit was an episode of Arrested Development. It actually makes me emotional talking about it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, with his whole family. It was amazing. It was beautiful.
What a gift to have that for your
what
whole family. And to be able to give that kind of tribute to him as well. Well, we know we only have about a minute left with you. In that time, I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about your family, especially. And I'm just wondering how the holidays are going to look for you guys this year. You know, what with it being 2020 and all.
I know. We're all having to get really creative. Well, you know, we have managed to work it out to where we're gonna be able to all come together. It's taken a lot of scheduling, and you know, my parents are doing a really great job of staying quarantined. I'm in New York City, so my fiance and I are going to have to do a little extra quarantining. We're going to quarantine for a week before we hop into the Howard bubble. And we're all going to, you know, me and my sisters and my brother, we're all going to be together and thankfully, you know, have a really nice holiday season to get together. So we're looking forward to that. It's going to be nice.
And if people want to buy tickets to the Howard bubble, is that something we can find?
They can watch the astronauts on Nickelodeon.
I don't think this year. Maybe another year.
All right. I'll look for that in future years. Paige Howard, an
so
actress,
much.
her father, Ron Howard, the whole Howard family, for crying out loud, film, television, theater. You can learn more about the upcoming role in The Astronauts by going to nick.com. So, interesting thing that she brought up that I would be curious with you, Lisa Valentine Clark, when we talk about, we sort of, you know, got this way, this idea of legacy.
Oh, yeah.
The one decision that you made that changed the trajectory of your family's life and, you know, everyone, you know, down the line. It was interesting, with yesterday being Veterans Day. Mm-hmm. My older brother, I think it was Ancestry.com, mm-hmm. Went in and found a couple pictures of my grandfathers and shared them on
really
social
cool.
media. And
I love seeing those photos.
Yeah, they're, you know, 100-year-old photos probably at this point, maybe a little bit less. But seeing the decisions that my grandparents made, and seeing how and what I've taken from their life that guides my life now is sort of an interesting thing. It's a thing that 20-year-old me would have been like, cool, what are we talking about, Richie? Let's move along. But, you know, 21-year-old me that I am today thinks entirely different about it. I don't think that any of those things that we call legacy are things that you go, I want my legacy to be. I don't think that's how legacy works. I mean, the Howard family, certainly I don't think that, you know, Ron Howard said, hey, this is what I want my family to know and be. I think he just was genuine as to who he was that was able to, you know, be seen through the family. And so I wonder, in a way that, you know, you won't have an answer maybe prepared necessarily, or that you won't actually even be able to know what it is. Mm-hmm. What would you like your legacy to be? And by the way, I'll caveat this. She's just fine, everybody. I just would be curious.
Right. No, it is something that our family has talked about with the recent passing of my husband, and I don't want to, referring to that, in a casual thing, but we have a different, I think, perspective in our family than most families do. No, caring for someone who's terminally ill, who sure. has time to think, what do I want my kids to know? What do I want my grandchildren that I'll never meet to know? And especially in writing your personal history. So this is my big plug for, well, write those things down that you want them to know, and then they'll know it. Like you have to write it down. So that's my big plug for journaling. But something that I really want my kids to know is something that my husband and I shared together is that we want to give them a legacy of faith. And
now, do you mean religious faith or just
yes?
Or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, a religious faith that we want our kids and our grandkids. This is important for us to know that this is not something that we just fell into. Mm. That this is our faith. Our faith in Christ, our faith in our religion is very important to us, and that it espouses and teaches such positive things that have changed our lives, mm-hmm. that have molded our lives in a way that we're not just going to say, oh, well, that was just by chance, or that was just because of whatever. So that is a big thing. And the other legacy that we want to live too is that you can do hard things, that idea of resiliency. And that's something that I also have taken from my grandparents and great grandparents who also went through some really difficult times, of that it's okay, you can go through that. And then the other kinds of legacies that I'd like to bring is a big one about humor.
Yeah.
And our family is one that, jokes around a lot and laughs and is looking for that good, and I would like that to continue as well. So those are kind of those are the three that kind of come to mind really quickly. Obviously there's other things.
Sure.
Like I wanted you to get a good education, and theater has been really important, and
all
reading
of
and yeah. learning and being constantly, helping and serving other people. But those kinds of characteristics are sort of secondary, I think, thanks to those big ones, if I can choose. And like you mentioned, sometimes you don't get to choose what your legacy is, but sometimes you do.
Do you get glimpses with your kids that legacy is being passed on?
Yeah, I think so. I think they won't question this or that. Like something I'll think, well, they should never question, that, we love them. They'll never question that this was important to me.
Hmm.
Things like that. I think, yeah, you harp on things. But one thing I have found as a mother is that you don't always get to choose what your kids remember or how they remember it, because they're having their own experience surrounding it as well. So it is an interesting thing. And also, I'm not done living my life as well. So who knows?
She's fine. Just fine. She is just fine.
Few years will be. I wonder if you think about legacy in terms of your career or your family or your impact on the world.
So personally, when I think about it, I sort of look at it like, okay. There was a moment within the coronavirus where I allowed my mind to go, what if this is the end?
Hmm.
What would I, when I had tested positive and feeling at my very worst, I never even went to the hospital. So it was just my dramatic brain that I allowed to take over. But I thought, if this is the end, if this is it, I'm shedding this mortal, all of these
coil.
Things. Yeah, this mortal mm-hmm. coil. What would I be remembered for, and would it even matter, right? Have I done a thing? Have I done singular one thing that mattered? And then there's a whole lot of, drama in my head as I, self-loathingly look at the various choices that I've made over my life, etc. But But to that point, I think if there is one thing that those that are in my family, mm-hmm. those who I have interacted with, you know, socially, those that I have worked with, those who, any of those kind of things, that that it is always joke first, that it mm-hmm. will be the humorous thing, right? The jab, the, you know, the whatever the thing is. Like, let's always go for that if we can. Let mm-hmm. us always go for that funny thing. And in a lot of ways, because I feel like people need a break, people need a reprieve.
There is
not everyone can bring that. So mm-hmm. I feel uniquely able to, in a lot of really awkward situations, be the person that people can connect to and be like, thank you for being funny about this really not very funny situation, but allows me to, you know, take some of the steam out of this whole thing. But then just one step beyond that, knowing that if anyone ever asked me for anything, that I would do that thing unfailingly.
Hmm. That people can count on you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a great, those are great.
And that's it. Every other choice I've made in my life, terrible. Not a single good choice. You can count on me to make terrible choices, except that I'll be a joke and then make it, you know.
And always with the joke. Hey, I love it. And thinking about it makes it more likely to happen.
Coming up in 6 minutes, we're talking to a world-renowned daredevil about what it's like balancing hundreds of feet above the ground.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Have social situations been stressing you out lately? In 20 minutes, we'll give you some tips for managing social anxiety.
Now, have you ever had one of those nightmares when you find yourself like in a high place,
yes.
walking on a rope, like a high wire?
Mine is always on the edge of a mountain.
Really?
Yeah. Like you have the fence that you're like, I trust the fence to keep me away from the fence is gone. That's my dream.
And then in the dream, if you fall off, then that's when you wake up.
Yes.
Oh, it's so weird. But just imagine if instead of a dream, it's real. You're just, the stakes are a little bit higher that you actually do that. I'm very afraid of heights. That's my thing.
Yeah. So you would not be found on the side of a mountain or atop a high wire?
No, I get the backs of my knees shake.
Do you get the tingles?
Yes.
I get the tingle up the back of my legs, and I'm like, okay, I'm done.
So I think it's so, if walking across a wire about being miles high in the sky seems crazy to you, well, it doesn't for Nick Walenda, aka the king of the high wire. It's a dream come true for him. Nick holds numerous world records. He's the first man to ever cross the Grand Canyon on a high wire. And he's with us today to talk about how he accomplishes these amazing feats. Welcome, Nick.
Thanks for having me on.
Okay, so for me, all my experience are dreams. So for those of us who aren't familiar with high wire stunts, can you explain, you know, what the high wire is, what the skill and the danger is associated with it?
Yeah, your nightmares are my dreams for sure. So,
so funny.
I'll kind of back up even further. So in the 1780s, my family started performing on high wires. High wire is basically a rope or a cable that is strung between, whatever it is, two different contraptions. It can be skyscrapers. Often several of my world records are between skyscrapers. But and it is a wire about the size of a nickel. And my family, again, started performing back in the 1780s, eventually making their way to the United States from Europe in 1928. I was born into that legacy in 1979 and have been carrying on that family tradition actually since before my feet were on terra firma. In fact, my mom was 6 months pregnant with me and still walking the wire.
What?
So
wow.
I actually started about 18 months old, only about 18 inches above the ground. And eventually took it to great heights, as you mentioned, first person in the world to walk across the Grand Canyon, Niagara Falls. Most recently, live on ABC, I walked over an active volcano and hold 11 Guinness World Records, doing what most people would be scared to death to do, and literally facing my fear.
So you are afraid a little bit.
Absolutely. Look, I would tell you that prior to 2017, I didn't really know what fear was as far as while being on that wire or fear of heights. 2017, we were training as a family to break a world record for the highest four-level, eight-person pyramid. And as we made our way out on that wire, that pyramid collapsed. And seven of my, well, there were eight of us on the wire. Five fell to the ground. I was able to catch the wire, as was my cousin and one other performer. But my sister was, they were all hurt pretty bad. In fact, statistics say there's about a 30% chance of surviving. And although I was okay physically, I was hurt mentally and didn't even know it. My sister broke every bone in her face. She was in a coma, internal bleeding. In fact, currently has 73 screws and plates in her face. Didn't know if she was going to live, but I did what everybody tells you to do, get back on the horse. So literally the next day I got back on the wire and performed for 5 weeks straight.
The next day?
While my sister was recovering. Yeah, that's right. So I do a lot of motivational speaking from the wire, and I was getting ready to do a tour. And the following day I got back on that wire, spoke to a crowd, and it was probably the most emotional walk besides the walk that I recreated where my great grandfather lost his life, but extremely emotional. But went on and continued to perform thinking I was doing what was right. And the reality was I was sort of just burying those thoughts of fear. And, you know, the book that I just wrote, Facing Fear, really, that's what it talks about, is that process of what I had to go through. And I remember going through that process. And as a family for generations, we've always believed that every negative situation can be used to bring positive to other people's lives. And even through this process, we knew there would be. So I started pinning down what I was going through mentally and emotionally, and then the process that I went through in order to overcome this small four-letter word that was the greatest challenge of my career. You know, through my career, I've done these things that people think are impossible.
Right.
Not to mention, just to walk across Niagara Falls took changing two laws in two countries that were over 100 years old just to get permission to do that walk, let alone the walk itself.
Wow. Yeah.
And people think that, you know, that must be the greatest challenge, and Nick Valenda must be fearless. And the reality is, before that accident in 17, I didn't think that fear was in my DNA, at least the fear of falling. Mm-hmm. Of course, I dealt with fear in my life, and I actually touch on that in several of the chapters of other fears, fear of failure, fear of success, even fear of, you know, so many financial failure, et cetera. I talk a lot about that in the book, but the reality is that gripping fear that actually caused me to get to the point where I remember going to my wife and after a rehearsal, where I was physically trembling on the wire and saying, I'm done. I don't think I can do this anymore.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget that conversation. My wife comes from seven generations of circus on one side, eight on the other. She holds two Guinness World Records, including one for hanging by her teeth over an active volcano, 1,800 feet up above that volcano, that
lava. And
what a power couple.
Yeah. And she said, look, I respect whatever choice you make, and I will support you. However, your family for over 200 years have lived by the words, the show must go on. You live by the words, never give up. And you do what you do to inspire people. And I don't think you are really thinking clearly right now, and you need to reevaluate, you know, your thought process. And that kind of sent me off into this spiral and whirlwind where I really had to relearn who I was, what I was made to do, what I was created for, and what my passions were. It sort of set me back, I feel like, a few years in life. And as I documented that, I thought, you know, I need to write a book, and hopefully it'll help others who are going through this. So when I started writing this book, there was no pandemic. We weren't dealing with coronavirus at that point, or this COVID-19. We didn't even know it was a reality at that point. But I was writing this book to the everyday person who is, I think so many people are held back from pursuing their dreams because of fear. It could be the fear of failure. It could be complacency. You know, so many people go to work every Monday, even though they don't like their job. They know that there's a paycheck Friday that'll cover the mortgage. So they continue going, but they give up on their dreams. And in the book, I talk about stories of my life as I grew up, where I continued to pursue my dream. I continued to work at the restaurant I was working at, waiting tables, but I also pursued my dream simultaneously. I didn't give up on that. I didn't settle into complacency. And because of that, I believe that is why my dreams will be able to come true. So this book is written to those that are gripped by fear, that are saying, you know what, I can't leave this job because my mortgage is paid. I can't pursue my dreams because I won't achieve that dream. So I encourage people, keep your job. but pursue that dream at the same time. And eventually that dream will become a reality and you won't be miserable every Monday to Friday. Yeah.
We're talking with Nick Wallenda, the king of the high wire, several record that you hold.
11 World Guinness.
Generations upon generations of performers and everything like this. I would be curious to know, what do you learn from the time when you're not on the high wire?
Gosh, you know, it's so many analogies that tie the two together. You know, I learned so much on the wire that helps me off the wire. A lot about training and preparation for everything that I do. So I would tell you that, look, I think we all, if we have the right mindset, can learn something every day. Every day I wake up, the first thing I pray for is wisdom. And I believe that we can learn something new as long as we're looking for it and we can continue to grow and continue to move forward. And that's really the way that I've tried to live my life. Now, when this accident happened, it stopped me in my tracks and basically the whole world froze for about 6 months as I rediscovered who I was. But, through the things that I do on the wire, it's built my confidence off the wire so that I'm able to be successful. You know, a lot of my wire walking is preparation. It's preparation for these events. For the Grand Canyon, I trained with 90-mile-an-hour winds on a cable that was rigged less stable and longer distance so that I knew that when I got to the Grand Canyon and I stepped on the edge, rather than being fearful, I could be confident taking that first step.
Right. I would love to back up a little bit and talk about the specifics of what it is that you do, because I do think that there are some parallels that, you know, and lessons that we can learn from this. And so to kind of take a step back and walk us back through this process of you doing this high wire walk that most of us will never do. For example, like, what kind of precautions do you take? What kind of safety measures? What do you do when you have that moment, I think I'm going to lose my balance?
Sure. And I talked a little bit about that when I talked about the accident back in 17 where I actually caught the wire. So my entire life, right, I've trained to grab that wire, and that wire is a safety. It's a safe haven. The reality is that wire is not going to fail. Again, we do studies. We have engineers. We have amazing scientists that work on our team from when I walk over things like volcanoes, but that show that wire is always going to be stable. So, you know, my training and preparation is just as much physical as it is mental. When I'm walking on the wire in my backyard that's 800 feet long, I am focusing on walking over that volcano. Mm. And when I'm over that volcano, I'm putting myself back in the backyard again. And it is about, all of my training is about training for worst case conditions. So I talked about the wind machines of the Grand Canyon. Niagara Falls, I trained with wind machines that created 120-mile-an-hour winds.
Wow.
And I trained with fire trucks actually hosing me down from above, from their ladders, kind of creating a heavy mist that I had to walk through. Again, on a cable that was rigged less stable, that was longer, and I would do, we call it laps, but basically I would walk forward and backward that entire length, sometimes 3-4 times in a row without getting off the wire. And that preparation is how I'm able to confidently take that first step, knowing, hey, I've done this 6 times in worse wind conditions than any of our studies have shown this will be, in heavier mist. I'm prepared for this. And then again, my training is to grab that wire and hold on. I've got rescue teams that stand by for my events that can get to me generally within 60 to 90 seconds. I am trained to hold on to that wire for 10, 15 minutes. But again, all about over preparing, if that's even possible. I don't even think that's really a proper way to look at it, but doing everything I can to prepare for worst case and then more than that.
So let me ask you this. It sounds like so much of what you write about and what you would speak about would be metaphorical, things that we could apply. I, as Lisa mentioned, will never be up on a high wire. I can guarantee you that. You've been taught your whole life to grab the wire. What is your figurative wire that you grab onto when you need that guidance?
Sure. So my faith is certainly a key to my success in life, and really my confidence and my mental success comes from my faith. So my wire is the Bible and the Word of God. So I do a lot of I spend a lot of time in the Word of God, a lot of time in worship music, etc. Because that is who I am. I was just born and raised as a born again Christian. And that is, again, where I find my grounding on and off the wire, whether I'm dealing with a stressful situation of raising 3 kids, which we've had the blessing and opportunity, amazing opportunity of doing, me and my wife, or, you know, dealing with traffic or dealing with walking over an active volcano, I really turn to my faith.
I love how you connect those three things, raising kids, driving in traffic, you know, high wire of a volcano.
Yeah.
They're just all
The teenage years are much like walking over
I
a volcano.
They are. It's funny. My great grandfather said it best. He said, life is on the wire and everything else is just waiting. And
wow.
I think that applies to everybody across the board. But for our family, it's very true. It is life. It is our passion. It is what we've done for so long that it is not an occupation. It's not a career. It's not a, it's not even a choice almost. It is just, it's almost in our DNA. And again, I think that everybody is on a wire right now.
Mm-hmm.
Before this pandemic, again, I wrote this book before this pandemic was a reality. In fact, I wrote another chapter at the end, a bonus chapter, because this pandemic came about. But we're all on a wire and we're all trying to get to the other side. And I've lived my life to try to inspire others that because Nick Walenda can make it across these extremely adverse conditions, you know, the volcano, I was 1,800 feet up above 2,000 plus degree magma, gases that were so thick that they actually absorbed the oxygen out of your lungs. So I had to wear gas masks. I had to wear goggles. I had to train for the heat. We actually had some of our stabilizer cables fail because the gases changed. It's funny that we had volcanologists on our team that were like blown away, but the gases actually changed days up to that event and actually caused a couple of my stabilizer cables to fail. But again, I do all of these walks to truly inspire others that, hey, we're all on this walk of life, and we're all trying to make it through to the other side. And if I can do it, so can you.
Wow. Inspiring people who are facing their own fears. And when you think about that preparation and that joy, I'm so struck that you're like, this is who we are. These, you know, this is part of the fabric of my family and my essence. So your favorite kind of walk or experience that you've had on the high wire, one, the highlight of your career, what has it been?
That's so tough. I mean, successfully raising three children is probably my most...
Man, I love
I've got three amazing kids. I've got a 22-year-old that's serving our country in the Marines, a 19-year-old serving our country in the U.S. Army, and then I've got a 17-year-old daughter who is going off to become a nurse.
Wow.
And, you know, I think that's the greatest gift we have as parents in life is the opportunity to raise children. And it's tough and it's challenging. And to be able to look back and say, wow, thank God they've made it and they're doing well is a huge accomplishment to me.
Oh, absolutely.
I need to know, do you have something planned for the future? Something even crazier, if that's possible.
What's next?
I'm always working on stuff. I'm working on a walk in the UK right now. I've wanted to do a big walk over there for quite some time. I can't talk specifics, but I'm also working on walking. I've walked from one state to another here in the US from North Carolina to South Carolina. I've walked from one country to another, which was from the US to Canada. And in Turkey, there is the Bosphorus, which I would be able to walk from one continent to another.
Oh, cool.
Which would be a dream of mine.
Cool.
I'm working on the pyramids in Egypt, and I'm also working on something in outer space.
What?
That sounds awesome.
I'm here for it.
I'm also going to pitch this, and it's a lot of cable, but transatlantic. That might be a distance.
It's a lot of cable.
But, I mean, it's possible. If you can dream
they say
you can do it.
Anything's possible. That's right.
Well, thanks, Nick. Nick Walenda, a.k.a. the King of the High Wire, holds 11 world records for his high wire stunts and is known worldwide for his daredevil mentality. You can find Nick and his website, nickwalenda.com, or on Twitter at N-I-K-W-A-L-L-E-N-D-A. Next up, in about 2 minutes, we're going to help you feel more comfortable approaching social situations.
You're listening to The Lisa Show.
Well, do you constantly fear being scrutinized and judged in social situations? I mean, I think that everybody has, at least to some degree, a little bit of worry about that. But how do you know if you suffer from social anxiety? Well, it affects about 15 million people in the United States. Social anxiety can be really hard to overcome and may involve an uncomfortable process. But with the right guidance and perseverance, it really can be done. So here today to help us understand social anxiety and how to conquer it is psychologist Dr. Kristen Bianchi. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So what are some signs that one might have social anxiety and not just be in an uncomfortable situation?
Great question. So as you had alluded to, at the heart of social anxiety, what we can see as a unifying thread is this fear of being negatively evaluated by other people. And so with that core fear, mm-hmm. we will see many patterns of avoidance, all sorts of different types of social situations. So that could range from a party, thinking pre-COVID,
right.
To giving a presentation, to initiating a one-on-one conversation, to speaking with persons of authority, to interacting with peers, or even to dating scenarios. So social anxiety does tend to be somewhat idiosyncratic in that people may have it in one life domain, but feel at ease in social situations in another. So you might see a professor, for example, who is comfortable giving a lecture, but who clams up and gets really nervous when students come in to meet one-on-one during office hours.
Interesting. How severe can social anxiety be?
It can be very debilitating. So at its most extreme, we can see people avoiding as many social interactions as they possibly can, staying at home, having very limited social support systems. That's at its worst. Typically what we'll see is, again, impairment in certain situations, whether that comes in the form of avoiding the situations or being in the situations, but just feeling miserable and kind of having to gut it out, but really not deriving any enjoyment from it. So there's a lot of suffering.
Right. To have so many people suffer with it, and when we throw out a number like 15 million, what are some ways that people can overcome anxiety?
Well, the way that we overcome so many anxieties is by directly facing the fear, which sounds alarming.
Which is the opposite
terrifying.
Of what people who have social anxiety want to do.
Oh, perfect. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And would that it were that easy. But what we do is we break it down into smaller steps. Mm-hmm. So let's say that someone is anxious, talking to people in their age range. Well, we'd figure out, we'd list a bunch of different scenarios in which they might encounter people their age, and then we'd find the ones that were the least difficult, so the easiest ones, and we'd have them start there. We would also practice, so we might give people some tips on things that they could say, for example, to initiate a conversation, so that they can sort of have that in their memory until they're able to do it more naturally. And with practice, that will come. But often when we are anxious in social situations, we freeze, and then we have a difficult time generating words. And sometimes that in and of itself is what people will fear, is kind of having this screen freeze and not knowing what to say.
So then their fear actually is realized.
Yes. And so when that happens, then they're worried what people will think of them. And then the anxiety jumps to the worst case scenario, which is that they'll be rejected, shunned, not welcome. And again, that possibility tends to be exceedingly unlikely, but anxiety always likes to go to the worst case scenario.
Yeah, it's real fun that way.
It's an interesting,
I know, right?
Yeah.
Thanks.
It's extreme. It's an interesting conversation that, as we think about it in the context of our children, we hear more and more in the news that our children are more anxious now than they have ever been. And I've got to think that this is part of that component. How does the conversation and or treatment shift as we're talking about this with our children?
Well, the treatment itself is identical. And so we would be doing the same things with kids that we would with adults. So we do a combination of what we call gradual exposure. So it's like we make a ladder of different types of social interactions of increasing difficulty, and we gradually work up that ladder until people are doing what they initially thought was the toughest thing to do. Eventually we get them to a place where they are able to do that and it doesn't feel so tough. We pair that with some social skills training. So sometimes, you know, especially for little ones, they may not, you know, they may or may not have social skills that are on level with their age. If they do, great. We want to just reinforce those and kind of review and remind them. If they don't, then we have the opportunity to teach skills that they will be using for their whole life. So there's really a lot of opportunity in working with kids and adolescents as well who have social anxiety.
We're talking with Dr. Chris Bianchi about how to overcome social anxiety, really at any age. If we are trying to overcome this and going out on a limb, are there certain things that we should avoid?
We should, as best we can, avoid avoiding.
It's funny.
Which, again, it runs counter to everything that our fight or flight response is screaming at us to do. But what we want to do is to find ways to push ourselves outside of our comfort zone in a gradual way. So we want to figure out, okay, where do I feel most safe and least threatened by social ostracism? But then we want to say, okay, what's something that I could do that would be mildly difficult, but that I think I can do, that I can push through and do this. And again, we start at the point of least resistance. You know, we could also bolster that with doing social type activities of a social nature in which we do have confidence. So again, social anxiety isn't typically going to extend to every single life domain. And so someone who, say, might have a great deal of anxiety with something like dating might feel okay interacting with peers in a platonic way. So we'd want to combine, lower level dating type behaviors, whether that maybe like initiating a conversation or sending a text message or something, and offsetting that with social activities or interactions that build confidence,
right,
such that, you know, they can see themselves as a social person in a holistic way.
What type of advice do you have for someone who does not have, say, social anxiety, but you know, one of their loved ones does? It's a thing. If I'm not being self-disclosing, someone whom I love very much and am married to has a bit of social anxiety, and
Richie doesn't have a drop of it.
Not a single bit. And so when she will open up and be vulnerable about how exhausting social settings will be, like I try and attach myself to it, want to care about it, and I just am like, I have no idea what you are experiencing.
Right. And thank you for sharing that. That's a great example. And I think many people on both ends of that equation can relate to that experience. So it is it's okay if you can't relate experientially. In many cases, people won't be able to because there is a discrepancy in what people find anxiety provoking. So one of the best things that we can do is to be supportive, to listen to what they're saying and kind of honor their vulnerability, even if we don't understand, even if the anxiety itself, the fear doesn't make sense to us.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to minimize it and say, well, what are you worried about?
Yeah, people to honor it.
That may be true. People can be very well liked and also have significant social anxiety. And so really just saying, how can I support you? I know this makes you anxious. What can I do? How can we get through this together?
Yeah. I assume that during COVID, when more people are spending time alone and isolated, it's certainly easier without the extreme sort of social consequences, whatever those might be during COVID. I assume that a lot of people are getting used to the idea of not going out a lot and not having to face their fears. Does this mean that social anxiety will get worse? And what do we do in this time of sort of forced social isolation in order to still make sure that our social anxiety is in check and not getting worse?
Yes. That's an excellent point. And yes, we are very concerned because now there are, legitimate reasons for avoiding the types of in-person interactions that make people anxious. And so there's not a whole lot that I can say as a therapist if someone's telling me that, they don't want to get together with friends in person, even if it's outside and mm-hmm. even if it's, a relatively safe setting, it's not for me to, to tell them what choices to make with regard.
Right.
To,
it gets a little bit more complicated than it has been.
Yes. Yes. So this is where we have to be creative and we have to figure out, okay, within the framework in which you're operating, what is outside your comfort zone? And how can we continue to work on overcoming social anxiety in the absence of these in-person interactions? And so we might, again, have to be creative, have to do things like having people use the phone. Whenever I make that suggestion, I get so many looks from people.
Call people on the actual telephone?
Yes, of all ages. It's not just my younger clients. It's everybody. They're like, you want me to do what?
That's funny.
So, like, well, people do use the phone sometimes.
Yeah.
So, we might find ways for them to, to make a phone call, to, mm-hmm. Let's say ask a question, is this item in stock? We might encourage a virtual get together where there is a shared screen so that there is at least some face-to-face contact. In the case of dating, again, that, because I do see a good bit of anxiety around that, if people are going to, likely be reluctant to get together in person, but are there ways that there can, still be some type of conversational interaction that is voice to voice, if not, even if it can't take place in person.
And just practicing that.
Yes, yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Really, yep. Really trying as best one can, making it a habit or part of a routine to keep practicing. So maybe pick one thing each day that you can reasonably do that would be a little bit outside your comfort zone, or even a lot outside your comfort zone, and to reward yourself for it, because this is hard. So, you know, not only would you be doing something that's hard, but you're doing something that also requires creativity, and odds are high that, you know, reserves are on the lower side right now anyway, just given all of the stressors that are going on.
One of the things that I loved you, that you said earlier, is the ladder approach to taking this on, just like you wouldn't go from the bottom rung on a ladder to the very top. It's a step-by-step approach. Yeah. Dr. Kristen Bianchi practices at the Center for Anxiety and Behavioral Change, and you can follow her on Twitter at Bianchi Kristen for more information on bettering your mental health.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything you need on the BYU Radio app, where you can listen on demand. Or you can find us over on Sirius XM channel 143.
If you like something that you heard, you want to hear it again, why not find The Lisa Show wherever you get podcasts? It's a great on-demand way for you to be able to share us with your friends and or get it whenever you want. Take us to the gym with you. I'll go grocery shopping with you. Lisa loves it if you go out on a run with her.
I do.
Take us with you. It's The Lisa Show, available wherever you get podcasts. Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.